Thank you for listening to the Redeemer Church podcast. For more information about our church, please visit www.redeemermidland.org.
Amen. Y'all take a seat. Good morning. Happy New Year. Thank you. I'll take you to coffee. If you have a Bible, let me invite you to turn to the Gospel of John, chapter 8. If you don't have a Bible, it will be on the screen here in front of you. As a church at Redeemer, we generically and generally love to take books of the Bible and just walk through them, but periodically we will pause from those and look at certain topics or texts or ideas that are pertinent to us. And very often, in fact, most of the time at the beginning of the year, we'll start off with kind of a realigning or refocusing or reminding topic, because we need to be reminded often about what our mission is and who we are as a church and who we are as Jesus followers. So these next few weeks are going to be really kind of taking some time to not take our identities for granted, but to really realign and refocus. There's a lot of power in focus. When I was a young boy, I remember me and two of my buddies all got magnifying glasses for Christmas, and I think we were supposed to use them to look at very small things, but instead we used them to do what? To burn ants and to light fires. Because we found out that there's a lot of power when you can take the sun and focus it, then you get some results. And as a church, it's incredibly important that we remain focused, because we've been given a very clear job to do. We have a very clearly defined identity about who we are as Christians and who we are as a church. And if we don't constantly come back to that plumb line and keep reminding ourselves of who we are, we very easily drift from that. This happens in every organization, be it a church or a business. If we don't be reminded often about where we're headed, then we constantly drift. There's a new book out and a new term called Mission Drift that looks at this idea that if we don't constantly revisit this, we just kind of drift away. And that's really important as a church that we don't do that, because it's really easy to do. I remember a long time ago, I heard a story, I think it was a made-up parable about something called a life-saving station. The story goes like this. There was off the coast of somewhere, there was this really dangerous rock outcropping, and there was all these ships that would keep crashing in there. So some people were filled with some compassion, wanted to start a life-saving station, so they built a little makeshift tent, and they got these four or five people that would just devote their lives and time to staying there and to saving people as they were wrecked on the coast. They were just really driven by this one mission to see people saved from drowning. And over time, some other people got to hear about what was going on, and they donated some money, and they showed up, and they wanted to help. And then a little bit more time passed, and they thought, hey, we need to do a better job, and this tent isn't good enough, so we need to build some better walls and have some nicer cots. And then very quickly, things shifted to where they were spending all their time and money on these buildings, and they just didn't want to let the people water, and so forth. Their new facility, and these people that were drowning now were bringing in mud and water, and so forth. And then you get a couple years later where there was just, this coast was just lined with country clubs that had just forgotten why they existed and forgotten what they were supposed to do. And listen to me, it's really easy for churches to do that. For churches to just keep meeting and, you know, pay more attention to the building and things going on that are external and forget who we are as a church. So we're going to start this year off with a reminder that this is who we are, not just as a church of Jesus, but as Redeemer Church in Midland, Texas. And I'll be using a phrase that we're going to unpack over the next few weeks, that we as a church, our identity together is that we are a gospel-centered missional family. Everybody say it with me. We are a... Well done. You did it. Started off the new year with a win. We are a gospel-centered missional family. So today I'm going to unpack what it means for us that we are gospel-centered. Everything that we do as a church and everything that we are as individuals is centered around the gospel of Jesus. Maybe you have heard the word gospel before. Maybe you have his teachings, his death, his burial, his resurrection, and you were kind of to put all that together and try and give it a name, the message of this entire package deal that is Jesus. Many times in the Bible, that's talked about as the gospel. The word means good news, that the life, the teaching, the death, the opportunity that Jesus offers us is good news. And that's what we center our lives on, and that has to do with our identity and our activity, who we are and what we do, both of those things. We can never take for granted that those are centered around the work of Jesus. And I love the song that we just sang, Jesus paid it all, that everything that had to be done for our identity in Christ, Jesus finished it. In fact, on the cross, one of the last things he said was, it is what? Finished. And so our identity, we are centered around the gospel in our identity about who we are, and our activity is centered around the gospel. So that's what I'm going to unpack today for just a few moments. If you are in John chapter 8, verse 2, say, ready. I love this story, and it may catch you off guard a little bit when we get into it and you realize it's about Jesus encountering this adulterous woman. You're like, that's a strange way to start off the new year. I think you'll find out up to this point in the start off the new year, and it's applicable to all of us in one way or another. Up to this point in the Gospel of John, John was one of the 12 apostles, and he spent a lot of time with Jesus. And what he's done basically up till now is Jesus has built up this ministry. He has done some incredible miracles. Thousands of people are following him. They wanted to hear him teach and see what he was able to do and be healed by him. And at the same time, his popularity was rising. Resistance against him was also rising, namely the scribes and the Pharisees. So they were somewhat of the kind of political, religious powerhouse people of the day. They had a lot of biblical knowledge, but they did not in their heart love God. And so Jesus would really save kind of his most scathing and difficult sayings for these people, not the quote-unquote sinners, but these people that were really self-righteous and thought they had no need for Jesus. And so he's getting a lot of popularity, but there's a lot of people that really want to see him taken out because Jesus not only was kind of undermining the Pharisees and their legalism by this unbelievable grace he had for broken people, but he actually had the audacity to call them sinners. They're like, hey, we're great. We're awesome people. We got everything together on the external. And Jesus, dead men's bones. You're like a bruise inside your heart. You're wicked. You're evil. You're like a tomb of dead men's bones. You're like a brood of vipers. He said, if you read through the Gospels and hear some of the things Jesus said to the Pharisees face to face, you kind of cringe. You're like, no wonder he got crucified. No wonder he got murdered. He told the powerful, self-righteous people that they were just as in need of forgiveness and grace as the woman that we're going to encounter today in John chapter 8. So here's the setup. Jesus was growing in popularity, growing in resistance, and weekly he would go into the temple, often in Jerusalem if that's where he was, because he was a teaching rabbi. If he was in another place, he would go to their synagogue on the Sabbath and teach, and people would come and they would listen to Jesus, which is unbelievable to think about. Jesus himself unpacked the scriptures. So he would read the scriptures and he would teach or he would preach on them weekly, much like we're doing today. We come every week and we sit under and listen to the preaching of the word. That's what took place here in John chapter 8. So this is where we pick up. John chapter 8, verse 2 says this. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and he taught them. And oftentimes these opponents listened to Jesus, but then the Pharisees, they would kind of intermingle in the crowds and pretend that they were there to listen to Jesus, but then they would lob in questions, and oftentimes it was more interactive, right, than our cultural church gatherings today. There would be a lot of questions, and Jesus would banter back and forth, so there would be these Pharisees that would embed themselves in the crowd and then just kind of throw some questions to try and really get Jesus in a precarious place, to try to get him to say something or do something that then they could use to get him really ousted or kicked out. So that's what's taking place. Verse 3 says this, the scribes and the Pharisees, these were people with a lot of Old Testament biblical knowledge, but again, did not love God in their hearts, did not love Jesus, wanted to see him removed. They brought a woman, right, to church. Imagine you were there, and I say this often, but one of the best ways for us, 2,000 years removed from the writing of this book, to really glean some of the power and the practicality of this book is to try to write ourselves into the story, to pretend that we were there and we were seeing and hearing and smelling what was taking place. So imagine you just woke up, you were a good Jew, and it was a Sabbath, so you were supposed to go to church, that's what you did, so you show up, oh, good bonus, Jesus is teaching, this new rabbi that's unbelievable and he's powerful, so you're excited, and all of a sudden this happens. And the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery. and placed her in the midst, and they said to him, so these Pharisees take this woman, put her right in the middle, and they tell Jesus, they say, teacher or rabbi, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Okay, let that sink in. Some of you are like, this is a strange way to start the new year. Now, in the law, they said, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. So what do you say? Now, if you're there, this is a tense moment, right, of conflict. You're that was caught in the act of adultery. They bring the Old Testament, and now these Pharisees have this real-life woman that was caught in the act of adultery. They bring her before Jesus, and they bust out the scroll and say, hey, Jesus, if you truly believe the Bible and the Old Testament, Moses says right here, if you're an adulterer, then you deserve to be stoned, because in their culture and in the entire Bible, marriage is held in an unbelievably high regard. And it was held in such a high regard that there was some incredible penalties for those that would commit adultery. And it was actually in the Old Testament that if somebody committed adultery, that they were to be stoned. And I feel like I have to unpack this just a little bit, because our culture has somewhat devalued the marriage and somewhat kind of marginalized the gravity of adultery. I don't know if you've ever been cheated on, but that's not a good feeling, right? Right? I mean, this weird culture that we live in where these things have changed. I was hanging out with some friends of mine last week that are not believers, don't claim to be believers, and they were talking about a friend of theirs, and they said he cheated on his wife, and they're like, you know, but it's going to happen. That's just kind of what people do. They said, quote, they said, it's not like he stole somebody's stereo. And I was like, what in the world happened to us? Like they're saying, I mean, he just committed. It's not like he stole somebody's stereo. And I'm looking around like they're joking, right? No, they were not joking. Like in our culture, this is such a strange thing. So if you look at this, like, man, Jesus, God really places an incredible value on marriage and adultery. So in their culture, this woman would have been one of the most despicable people like ever. They're like, oh my gosh. Wow, she deserves death. And so they're trying to pin Jesus in this difficult place where now Jesus, in their mind, has only two choices. Either he adheres to what Moses says and does something, one, wildly unpopular, and two, actually illegal, because he would be usurping the power of the death penalty from the Roman Empire. And so he would be, you know, messed up if he did that. Or they thought he would just kind of do away with the importance of the Old Testament and Moses. And they're like, oh, we got him. We've got him in a position where it doesn't matter what he does, he is in trouble. Verse 6. Well, yeah, before we get there, writing ourselves into the story. I don't know how many times I've read this story, but for the first time this week, I tried to write myself into the shoes of this woman. Okay, we don't know really much about this woman, don't know her name, don't know any before or after. All we know is these few verses about her, but we can kind of infer some things about her. I'm guessing is that she had some feelings of guilt, because was she innocent or guilty? Guilty. Jesus never says that she's innocent. She was obviously guilty. They caught her in, it says, the act of adultery. So she probably had some guilt. My guess is she probably had some shame. In a culture like that, where somebody that had committed adultery would be socially ostracized, and now what she thought was a sin in private had just become incredibly public. Both families knew about it. The entire community knew about it. She was filled with shame. She knew from that moment on her life could never be the same. She could never go to the same family reunion. She could never go to the same places. She would always be looked at differently. She had guilt. She had shame. And no doubt, she had unbelievable fear. I mean, very literally, she was being drugged to this meeting, being set before the most powerful rabbi in the area, and there's this possibility that she, that day, is going to be stoned. And she's terrified. She has to be. And in the middle of this meeting, Jesus has this conversation with these Pharisees. It says this in verse 6. This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him, because the Pharisees, they really didn't have any compassion for this lady. They were just using her as a bargaining chip with Jesus. I don't think they really were concerned too much about the law, because the law said that both the man and the woman were guilty, and they just conveniently left the man out of this equation and just brought this woman. But it says that they did this so that they might test him to bring charge against him. And it says, so Jesus bent down, funny, finger on the ground. And I just, that's funny in the sense that they were pinning Jesus, and he had really only two ways, and they were both, you know, kind of get him in a difficult place. So he just pauses and bends down and just kind of writes in the dirt. And there's a lot of people, if you read commentaries, that have guesses as to what Jesus was writing. Some people say that he was probably like quoting some scriptures. Some people say he was probably writing some very detailed sins about that all the other people standing around had. Some people think he was just kind of doodling, you know, maybe making some emojis or just kind of passing the time while people thought about what was going on. We don't know, but he bent down and he was just writing in the dirt. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let he who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and he wrote in the ground. You've got to love Jesus, because they would do this often to him. They would put him in a position and he would just kind of turn the tables. And so he doesn't really bite on either of these options they gave him. Instead, he reorients this to remind them who it is that rightfully can sit in judgment and cast the first stone. And again, if you are innocent, or if you are without sin, then you get to be the one to pick up and to cast the first stone. And again, if you just showed up this day for a normal day of church, this is a really tense moment, right? This is the climax of the story. You're thinking, oh, gosh, this is going to get weird. This is going to get awkward. Verse 9. But when they heard it, it says, they went away one by one. And I love this phrase. It says, beginning with the older ones. It doesn't give us a lot of detail, but I think maybe there's some added wisdom and maturity and humility from some of the older ones in the crowd. So they begin to think back on their past and think that, well, they're surely unqualified to throw stones if that's the qualification to be sinless. So the older people just slowly start walking away all the way down to the youngest until everybody is gone. Verse 10, and Jesus stood up, and this is the first time he talks to this woman. This is the first verbal exchange that Jesus has with this lady. Jesus stood up, and he said to her, "Woman," which in Greek, in their culture, was a term of respect. It's not like today, you don't just show up and say, hey woman, can I have some coffee, right? That doesn't go well. It's different. That's not what Jesus was saying. This is some incredible honor. This woman, he talks to this woman, and Jesus gave women just some incredible honor and dignity that most of the culture did not. So he speaks to her one-on-one, and he says, "Woman, where are they?" And she's like, "I don't know, but they're gone. I'm glad they're gone. I really didn't like those guys. Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, and here's the phrase that we're going to unpack for a few minutes, because this is the phrase that's not just applicable to her, it's applicable to us, and it informs how we focus in and live our lives as gospel-centered people. Jesus, the first time he talks to this woman, he says this, "Neither do I condemn you, go, and from now on, sin no more." That's good news, right? If you're that woman, this could have gone a couple different ways, most of them not ending well. And my guess is she was not expecting to hear good news, because the Pharisees were quote-unquote religious people. They did not have good news. They had a bunch of good ideas and good expectations. And if you showed up to a service and the Pharisees were leading it, they would open up their scroll and read it and tell you all what to do and give you good advice on how you should change yourself. And then go away and good luck. But Jesus didn't have that. Jesus had what the gospel means, good news. Because good news is very different than good advice. Amen? All of us, this is like the new year, so everybody's kind of getting ramped up on New Year's resolutions, and we've got this whole list of things that we need to change and things that we need to do, and we've got good advice, and so we're thinking forward. I need to quit eating sugar. I need to work out four times a day. I need to quit spending money. I need to do better with date nights. I need to do better with all these things. That's good advice. That's all fine and dandy, but that's not the same thing as good news. Jesus didn't show up to give you a whole bunch of things to do. Jesus just shows up, and he just says, "I don't condemn you. So go and sin no more." She's like, "Oh, that's good news, because I thought I was about to be stoned." See, the good news, the package deal for Jesus, his life, his ministry, his teaching, his death, his resurrection, and the invitation for you to become a Christian is packaged around good news. It's not good advice about what you should do better. It's good news about what Jesus has done. And if we don't constantly remind ourselves of the centrality of the gospel, our identity, we tend to kind of drift away and start kind of relying on our works rather than Jesus's works. We get on this roller coaster. You know, if our identity is not gospel-centered but me-centered, we get on this roller coaster where if we have a good day, we're feeling great. If you have a bad day, you feel like God doesn't love you, like he's distant, like then you start comparing yourself to other people and you use Facebook and Instagram, right? And you're like, hey, they got it all together. They got no problems. And you compare and you think, well, I've got more problems than they do. And then it kind of drives you to be frustrated and discouraged because we're not centered on what Jesus has done for us but what we're trying to do for him. This gospel centrality affects two main things. It affects our identity, who we are, and our activity, what we do. Both of those, our salvation and our sanctification, have to be centered on the gospel. We have been saved by what Jesus has done, not by us, and we can be, what he said to her, we can be sent to go and sin no more, and even that act of sanctification is not just centered around us trying to work really hard so that we can please God. It's driven from him already being pleased in us because he's met the qualifications through his son. You with me? So our identity is wrapped up in Jesus. Our identity, who we are, is centered in the gospel to go and sin no more, to live lives that are pleasing to Jesus, trying to be sanctified in this list of things that we need to work on and improve. Even that is centered on the gospel. So I think, you know, just if you listen to this story, you think that's a kind of an odd story to start off the year. And maybe we feel like we don't have that much in common with some of the players. But I promise you that we have much more in common with that woman than we might think. Sometimes we read that like, whoa, that was crazy. She's bad. I'm glad I'm not that bad. Anybody? Don't raise your hand. And yet Jesus kind of raises the bar and he says, well, you know, I know this was an external thing and she got busted for an external sin. But he says, if you've ever actually lusted after somebody in your heart, you're the same playing field. You're guilty of adultery. So if we use that playing field, and Jesus is actually concerned about the things in our heart, about pride and self-righteousness and greed, then we are on the same playing field with her. And so Jesus' interaction with this woman has much more to do with you and I than we might think on the surface. Or we can kind of connect with the Pharisees, everything together on the outside. Their problem was not that they had these external sins. Their problem was that they had everything together on the outside. So everybody could look at them and say, hey, they're checking all the boxes, they're reading their Bible, they're going to church, but inside they had these really difficult and ugly sins, and the worst of which was being self-righteous. They thought they didn't need Jesus. And I would submit that's one of the most predominant sins and challenges in Midland, Texas, in the Bible Belt. It's this idea that I'm a good person, I'm moral, I've got everything together on the outside. I don't really think I need Jesus. And that would put us in the same boat with them. And so it doesn't matter which side you fall on, whether you have these just overt sins or this maybe struggle with self-righteousness or maybe both. My point is that this is applicable to all of us. And so Jesus meets this woman and he has this interaction with her that is just staggering. It really is scandalous what he said to this lady. And that he was willing to forgive her because of all the things that she had done. And so I want to unpack a couple things for you that what this passage and this interaction teaches us about the centrality of the gospel for us. Number one, this gospel that we learn, especially in this story, teaches us that Jesus will meet you right where you are at. Jesus will meet you right where you are at in whatever sin, whatever struggle, whatever question, whatever fear, whatever anxiety that you have. We kind of have this mentality, and godless religion teaches us this, that if we're going to get to God, then maybe God will kind of come halfway, but we need to get some things together and kind of make up the other half. I was out with our kids a few months ago, and there's a walking trail out by our house, and there's a lot of ants apparently out there that I was not aware of. And so I was having a good time until I looked back, and Hudson, our youngest, was back there just screaming. I'm like, what's going on? I'm like, oh, he's standing in a fire ant hill. That's not good, right? And so this is what I did not do, okay? I did not run halfway and then stop and say, all right, buddy, that was dumb, all right? That was a foolish thing to do. You got yourself into a mess. Now get yourself out of it. You need to think. You need to get those ants off. I've come halfway. You need to meet me halfway, right? What a horrible dad I would be. What did I do? You're like, I don't know. I wasn't there. I'll tell you. I see him. I was like, this is not going well. And I run, right, full speed, and I grab him, and I pick him up, and I take his blue rubber boots off, and I take his pants off, and I'm like, just, you know, if somebody didn't know what was going on, and they were just like a few hundred yards away looking, they're like, I don't know. This is like an aggressive spanking he's about to get. I take over, right? If my kid's in trouble, I'm going to go save them, and I'm going to meet him where he's at. I'm not going to go halfway and then make him kind of, you know, do his part. Jesus does not meet this lady and say, hey, listen, I'll give you a week. And if you can knock it off, if you can quit being an adulteress for 1 week, meet me back here and then we'll talk. He does not give her anything to do. The first words that he says to this woman who was no doubt guilty, it's not that Jesus pretends that she's innocent, it's that Jesus forgives her. And those are two very different things. Because if Jesus could just pretend that there was no guilt, there would be no reason for him to go be pinned up on a cross. He knows she's guilty, and instead of condemning her, he goes to the cross, dies for her sins, and is able and willing to look at her in the eyes and say, listen, nobody else had the ability to condemn you because I said, if you're without sin, cast the first stone. And I'm the only one, Jesus would say, that is without sin, that has the ability to exact judgment. And this is what I decide to do, to forgive. Because Jesus meets sinners where they're at. Because we cannot change ourselves. Our primary problem is not that we sin. Our primary problem, apart from Jesus, is that we are sinners by nature. And we can't just change our activity. That's the good news of the gospel. He doesn't come in. And maybe you've been to church before. You come in just a little beat up by life. You come in with some struggles and some fears and some sins that you're just kind of wondering what in the world you're supposed to do, and you show up, and maybe you were just kind of heaped on with religion, with, you know, knock it off, stop doing that. Here's a list of things you should do better. But that's not good news. Good news is when you show up and Jesus says, I know that you're guilty. I will pay for that. I will die for that. You are forgiven. Go and sin no more. He changes identity, like who we actually are. That's why there's terms in the Bible that talk about us being born again, being converted, because there's an inner change that is the first thing that happens when somebody becomes a Christian. That's gospel-centered. It's about the work that Jesus does in our heart. And then he sends us out to what? To go and sin no more. We have gospel-centered identity and still gospel-centered activity. We do try to live lives. Like, you know, maybe if you didn't make New Year's resolutions, you should write this one this afternoon. My goal for 2019, sin no more. Right? How are you going to do with that? Are you going to do it perfectly? Do you think this woman left from that meeting and never committed another sin again? Absolutely not. But in our terms, I honestly believe that she was gospel-centered in her desire to live a sinless life, to grow in obedience. It's not because she was afraid God wouldn't accept her or that Jesus wouldn't have grace. She had met Jesus face-to-face, and he had grace for her in her worst moments, so she is now grace-driven, gospel-centered desire for sanctification and holiness and good works. Are y'all with me? That's what we are as a church. We're serious about good works, but not until people are changed by the gospel. So if you're coming in here, you're not a Christian, you're beat up, this is what I don't want you to hear. Here's the commandments. You've broken them. You need to try harder. How many of y'all, you're like, that's not good news. I've been trying hard my whole life. Here's the good news. You show up, Jesus says, yeah, here's the commandments. You've broken them. I died for them. If you will simply come to me, confess, believe in me, I will forgive you, change you from the inside out, and then send you on your way, driven by grace, to go and sin no more. See, if we don't refocus on this often, naturally, as humans, we devolve back to religion. Even as Christians, we devolve back to finding our identity, not in what Jesus did, not in the fact that Jesus said, it is finished, but thinking that we've got to keep it together and we've got to obey, or he's not going to love us, and we get frustrated with ourselves when we're on this obedience roller coaster. Constant, we've got to push our identity back to what Jesus did. I mean, Paul, The Apostle Paul had to do this. Listen, if the greatest Christian on the planet had to do this, we'll probably have to do it too. And in Philippians 3, you find this story where Paul says, listen, I've got a pretty awesome resume. Hebrew of Hebrews, tribe of Benjamin, circumcised the eighth day. I mean, he just starts running through the list of if you could find your identity in what you've done, he's like, I'm the man. Like, I've done it. I'm zealous. I persecuted people that I thought were against. I've done everything. And he says, all those things I count as loss that I might be found in Christ. He's like, I'm still struggling to not find my identity in what I've done, but in who Jesus is. That's firm foundation. If you want a firm identity for the rest of your life, then labor every week to find your identity in the gospel. With gospel-centered identity, what's the answer to who we are? It's what Jesus has done. And we don't gravitate towards that. The gospel, as we remind ourselves, pushes us towards that. And then we have to remind ourselves and preach to ourselves often that our desire for good works and sanctification is driven by the gospel. It's gospel-centered. We're not trying to do things so that we can earn God's love. We're doing things because we already have it. There was nothing in this woman that walked away thinking, I've got to do some things so Jesus will love me. What was she thinking? Jesus loved me. I got to do some things. Listen, some of you in the room, you need to do centered in our driven by the gospel. If we're gospel-centered in our identity, it drives us to want to do what he's commanding her to go and sin no more. So that's what we mean when we say we as a church are a gospel-centered missional family. Our identities are completely wrapped up in what Jesus has done for us. And our activity is completely wrapped up in what Jesus has done for us and what he can do for others. And if we don't realign on that, we just very gradually and consistently drift away from that. So where does that leave us? I want to challenge you just in these next few moments, because I realize that there's people in the room from all different spectrums. You've been walking with Jesus for decades, been walking with Jesus for years, maybe brand new Christian, maybe you're curious, maybe you're a skeptic and you don't even really know that you believe that the Bible's true and that Jesus is a historical figure and that he is who he says he is. But wherever you are on the spectrum, Jesus made some claims and he did some things with sinners and had some interactions that has utterly changed the world, especially when he died on a Roman cross, was put in a grave for 3 days, and then rose from the dead alive to prove that his words were true. And this was his declaration of who he was, that he did not come into the world the first time to condemn. It says that he came into the world to save. And so my invitation for you is to not try to reach God and think that he will meet you halfway. Listen, I talk to people all the time, people in our house all the time, meet at Starbucks all the time with people. Some are not believers, and I try to gauge like if there's a barrier or a question that they have that's keeping them from becoming a Christian, having a relationship with Jesus. And often people will have this kind of nagging sin or struggle that they have, and they will feel internally, or maybe they've been told by somebody, that they need to get it together. I hear often people, I can't come to church, I can't be a Christian, I can't follow Jesus because I've got this sin and this struggle and this problem, and I gotta do better. I gotta master before I gotta meet him halfway. And it couldn't be further from the truth. Listen, the cross happened. Jesus was crucified because you can't make it halfway. I can't make it halfway. Jesus was crucified so that he could come all the way to meet you where you are at. So it doesn't matter what you've done, where you're at, what your struggle is. You don't have to change anything. You have to confess, repent, and believe. And Jesus meets you where you are at. Second thing, not only does he meet us where we're at, he changes our identity. He changes who we are. He'll meet us where we're at, but he won't leave us where we're at. He'll send us on a gospel-driven, grace-driven journey of obedience and sanctification. So maybe you need to hear this gospel centrality that Jesus has done something we just simply can't do, and you need to fall on the mercy and grace of Christ. Maybe you really feel like you jive with this lady. Maybe you feel like you jive more with the Pharisees, but either way, you realize there's a there's a distance between you and Jesus, and you need to hear that you don't have to work halfway. Jesus has worked all the way to you. It is finished. There's an opportunity for scandalous grace if you believe in Christ. And then for us, for the rest of this year, we're on this journey. We take holiness seriously. Like, we seriously want to live sinless lives, want to strive to obey Jesus and be full of good works and share the gospel with people in Midland so that we can see people saved and baptized and come into relationship with Jesus and grow. But it's all driven by the gospel of the grace of God. So maybe it's a peculiar story, maybe it's a strange way to start the year, but I think that there's a message in it for each one of us from Jesus. So I want to invite you to bow your head, to close your eyes, and I want to pray very specifically towards that end, that our hearts would truly feel this unbelievable beauty and weight of this good news. And maybe you've been to church before just hoping for some good news, but all you've got is good advice. I want you to hear from Jesus that he's full of grace and truth, and that's good news. Jesus, we love you. God, I pray that you would maybe shake us up and our hearts and minds up from the norm. Maybe we've heard this story many times, but we just have forgotten how scandalous it truly is that Jesus could take a woman that had been caught in adultery and just on the spot forgive her and change her and send her out to be a new person. God, I pray that you would remind us again what it took for ourselves to invade our hearts and minds, and just remind us with clarity once again that Jesus was willing to be brutally and shamefully beaten and crucified because of our sins, so that you might look us in the eye when we confess and say, I do not condemn you. Jesus, you suffered in our place so that you might set us free. God, I pray for someone in this room that's carrying some heavy weight of guilt and shame and fear. God, they've come to this place. I pray that they might hear the good news. God, that something had to be done, but you did it, and it is finished. And so you've given them an opportunity to be saved and changed. God, for those of us who are believers, I pray that you might send us out, driven by your grace, to be full of good works, to go and sin no more. God, in these next few moments, I pray that you'd find our hearts in a place that's honoring you in the way that we worship, in the way that we sing and give, and even in communion. Jesus, I pray, just as a shepherd and a pastor, that you would give us the grace to be centered both in our activity and our identity around your son, Jesus, the most important person there has been, the most powerful name that there will ever be. Jesus, would you be the center of our church and our lives this year? And I pray this in your name.